This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work Policy and Practice at the University of Chicago. The master's program in social work, social policy, and social administration prepares professionals to address today's most pressing challenges and offers flexible options with part-time and evening classes to support busy adults balancing complex schedules. Inspire change, shape the future at crownschool.uchicago.edu/social work. This WBEZ podcast is supported by Wise, the app for international people using money around the globe. With the Wise account, you can send, spend, and receive in up to 40 currencies with only a few simple taps. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. Terms and conditions apply. Be smart. Get Wise.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. Make sure you stick around for a breakdown of the day's top stories in the Chicago area at the end of this episode. But first, a recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling is raising big questions about who gets a seat at the table in American democracy. The High Court's landmark decision to gut a key stipulation in the 1965 Voting Rights Act and void a Louisiana congressional map overturned a decades-old precedent. Critics say the impacts will be felt by Black and Latino voters across the country, and that the ruling could make it harder for communities of color to elect leaders of their choice. This episode of the podcast will unpack that decision, and a panel of people working in law, voter policy, and civic engagement help us break down what this could mean for Illinoisans. At the table was Stevie Vias, Executive Director of Chicago Votes. That's a nonprofit working with young people to build a more inclusive democracy. Karen Freeman Wilson, who's President and CEO of Chicago Urban League, an organization that advocates for civil rights and economic justice for Black Chicagoans. She's also a former mayor of Gary, Indiana. And Chika Okafor, who's an assistant professor of law at Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. This news is a shocker, so I wanted to get their initial reactions to the ruling. Karen went first.
Well, it felt like a gut punch. And I'd like to say that I didn't expect it, but I did. And there has been just a systematic dismantling of the Voting Rights Act over the last 7 to 10 years by the Supreme Court. And the first thing I thought about is that elections really do matter. Mm-hmm. And they gave us this Supreme Court, and now we've got a lot of work to do.
Yeah, Stevie, what's the first thing that went through your mind?
Well, that it's a shame that, first of all, this is the Voting Rights Act is the signature accomplishment of the civil rights movement. It was passed in 1965. It's a shame that we haven't passed more laws since then to ensure that this couldn't happen. The next thing that went to my mind is that I wish we could elect the Supreme Court and that they weren't appointed. Mm-hmm. And the next thing that went to my mind is that I'm also not surprised. It's no wonder that this gutting of the Voting Rights Act happens on the tail end of the most diverse Congress in American history, with the most racially diverse Congress in American history. Mm-hmm. And the MAGA movement, Project 2025, this is what they set out to do. And they're doing exactly that. And I wish that our movement would be as aggressive and would pass as radical things to make sure that the voting rights of minority communities, Black communities, marginalized communities are protected and centered.
Professor Okafor, did you see this coming? Karen wasn't surprised. How about you?
Yeah, I would agree with that. Wasn't surprised. I think that many who are practicing and do work in this space saw what was happening when the court decided to have a re-argument of mm-hmm. the case and to broaden what they were responding to have it become a constitutional question of whether or not racial redistricting was in response to the 14th and 15th Amendment. So a lot of people suspected that this would be a landmark decision, that mm-hmm. there would be a huge change in what we conceived of and how we thought about the Voting Rights Act. But I still think that there are some who were surprised at how far this decision went in making it very difficult to, like, really to bring cases that show violations of Section 2. And so I think that the extent of the decision, I think, was surprising to some.
What's your biggest fear following this decision?
Whether it's a fear or what, you know, may just be a consequence is that, the court has made it such that it is very difficult to cases that talk about state actions that might be reducing the political opportunity of racial minorities. And so when it comes to political representation in Congress and in other elected offices, and we're starting to already see this in the midterms with Florida and other states in the South that are starting to shift the districting maps, there is a very likely scenario in which it becomes a lot harder for previously majority and minority mm-hmm. black districts mm-hmm. for them to be elected to office. And this ripples across various other areas of society in that mm-hmm. It might be harder for just Democrats in general to preserve the same kind of level of representation that they've had in previous years.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's one of the greatest concerns that we're starting to see unfold already.
Karen, talk to me about how this ruling is going to change maybe your approach at the Chicago Urban League.
So when I think about our approach has generally been to, one, educate people generally about voting. I think that we have to be much more specific in terms of helping to demystify rulings like this and other Supreme Court rulings. I think we also have to be very intentional in terms of partnerships, mm-hmm. like with Chicago Votes, like with other entities that will allow us to move across the age lines, mm-hmm. across racial lines, across lines of all marginalized voters. And then we have to communicate between our Urban League affiliates. There are 93 Urban League affiliates throughout the country, many of them in the South mm-hmm. where voting is in peril.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are things that we can do to work together that will make a real difference.
Yeah. Tell me, Stevie, about what this ruling changes for the civic engagement approach at Chicago Votes.
Our approach is going to remain largely the same. I think the urgency and the way we talk about our approach is going to change a little bit. You know, we do focus also on civic education, so making sure these young people that are becoming voters, becoming civic participants, understand what the Voting Rights Act is and why it was so important to our movement. But also, we have to advocate for systemic change here locally. The reality is Illinois has a trifecta of Democrat control in the House, the Senate, and in the governor's mansion. And what really stuck out to me about the decision was that difference between impact versus intent. So you can do something that has discriminatory impact as mm-hmm. long as you don't say you were intentionally doing it. And what that opened my eyes up to is how many things currently in our systems have discriminatory impact that are not stated as intentional, including the disenfranchisement of people who are incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
Majority of people who are incarcerated are black people, are brown people, are marginalized people, are poor people. And states across the entire country disenfranchise people who are incarcerated, including Illinois. And so we're going to be pushing on the Illinois legislature, the governor, the speaker, the Senate president, to pass the RACE Act, which will restore voting rights to people in prison. I think that's a good counter to what mm-hmm. the Supreme Court decision was.
And so we make sure everybody's on the same playing field here, Professor. Just briefly walk us through that decision, right? We had a 6-3 vote along ideological lines. Tell us the arguments by the conservative majority and the arguments by liberals in dissent.
Yeah, so With this case, you know, Louisiana v. Calais, it's, as you mentioned before, it's one of the most significant voting rights cases in at least a generation. And with this case, what the court has done is it made it much, basically they dramatically narrowed Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. Section 2, among other things, was the area of the Voting Rights Act that was basically allowed individuals to challenge state actions that were viewed as potentially discriminatory. And what this decision has done is that there are various things that have resulted. One is that, as my fellow panelists mentioned, changed the standard from discriminatory impact and outcomes to intent. And so what this means is that previously there was a format, Jingles preconditions, that more or less set it such that if individuals satisfied certain standards, that this would be what the court would apply in determining whether or not Section 2 was violated. What the recent decision has done has made it so that in the past, instead of showing that there was discriminatory outcomes that were impacting black and minority interests, now it's a standard of, you have to show that instead of them having a discriminatory impact, it was about intent. Another major change is that in this decision, it talked about it basically separating outcomes, separating race from politics, and that what you need to show is that it's not, basically states can defend the districting that they're doing under the grounds that they were doing it for political reasons. And as many people in the social sciences and in the law and in other areas recognize, given the history, given the context in the U.S., race and politics are deeply intertwined. They're deeply connected, deeply correlated. And so states can redistrict in ways that are reducing the political opportunity for minorities, but then say that they did it purely for political reasons. And them simply saying that they were doing it for political reasons protects them from the actual impact of those policies. And
that's really a mythical distinction, too.
There's an argument from the conservatives that we need, quote, colorblindness in policy. What do you make of that, Karen?
No such thing.
Right.
There's no such thing. And, you know, let's go with them for a minute and say, okay, we're going to be colorblind from now until eternity. You can't erase the absence of having been colorblind for the last 400 years. What do you do about that? And I think they're saying, oh, well, which is just not not acceptable. And that's why Congress needs to act. Now, you know, it's kind of, so the question becomes, can they act? Because now you have essentially weakened or potentially weakened Congress. But I think that is one of the safety nets such that it is.
Another thing that I wanted to add about the colorblindness point is that a good amount of the reasoning from the case is this perspective that colorblind policies, race-neutral policies will move us closer to fairness, to merit, to justice. And my research demonstrates that this assumption is wrong. Using economics, I mathematically demonstrate that in a world in which there is fully colorblind policies, fully colorblind decision-making, that belonging to a minority group leads to disproportionately fewer opportunities. And this, the reason for this is pretty straightforward. Opportunity flows through relationships, through who you know, through who refers you, and that because of the tendency that we have to associate with others similar to ourselves, belonging to a smaller social group, which are minorities, leads to kind of distortions in how opportunities are allocated. And so this isn't really about malice. It's about math when it comes to what I show in the model. Obviously, if you layer on the history, if you layer on the context in the U.S., then this dynamic, which I call social network discrimination becomes even more stark and shows that belonging to smaller groups, belonging to minorities will lead to disparities even if there is colorblindness.
This ruling, Stevie, dismantles the Voting Rights Act, as we've been talking about. This Supreme Court has also effectively ended affirmative action. The Trump administration has been outright hostile toward, you know, any effort to promote DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. How do you keep young people motivated to be civically engaged in the face of all of that?
Well, it's a fight, you know. We got to encourage the young people to fight. Got to encourage the young people to lead the next generation of a movement. The Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, the history of our civil rights movement was led by young people, and that should continue to be the case. And young people also need to come up with the proposed solutions to the systemic racism that exists in our society, the systemic oppression that exists in our society. And we're encouraging young people to be innovative. Yes, we need to make sure that we're protected here in Illinois and Chicago. We need to make sure that we fight for the Voting Rights Act to be strengthened, to be revived. But also, we have to fight for more things. We have to really look at the world that we live in now, think about the path that we're heading in, and propose policy solutions that may not currently have ever existed in the United States or around the world. But we're dealing with new times. Who would have ever thought that a simple word, impact versus intent, would be the thing that guts the movement that saw so many lives taken? And as the descendant of enslaved Africans, this is our fight. That Jim Crow wasn't that long ago. My grandmother grew up in Jim Crow. So we're not far removed, and we got to keep the fight alive, keep hope alive.
Yeah. There's a worry, Karen, that this could hamper future Black leaders in the making. You think so?
I don't think it has that impact. And the reason that I believe that, if we were to simply accept it and lay down, you'd be right. But this ought to be an energizing, a motivating factor that says not only will we lead, we'll lead in a way that really allows us to overcome what is clearly a concerted effort to muffle voices and to, at the end of the day, really repress a growing majority-minority group.
Like Stevie said, it's a fight.
Yes.
Right?
In a nutshell.
It's a fight. Professor, what's it like to teach law at a moment like this?
Yes, I think, teaching law at a moment like this is invokes a lot of emotions. This past year, I was teaching the 14th Amendment, and this is an amendment that is instrumental, the most litigated amendment in the Constitution. It's covers not only the reasoning in this Louisiana v. Calais decision, the reasoning behind which they, you know, dramatically narrowed the Voting Rights Act. It's also the reasoning with the birthright citizenship. It's also baked in with the 14th Amendment. And so one of the things that has been on my mind in response is that I think that there is a temptation for despair, but I don't think that the history points in that direction. If you look at what the Reconstruction, the 13th Amendment, the 14th Amendment, the 15th Amendment, these amendments came after the Civil War, and they were what made former enslaved people citizens of this nation, began to give them rights, began to give them political rights as well. And after that, there was backlash. There was a variety of different actions that in one way culminated with Plessy v. Ferguson, which created separate but equal, led to generations of Jim Crow. And then there was arguably the second Reconstruction, which was the civil rights movement, mm-hmm. in which we had the Voting Rights Act, which we are discussing today. There was a Civil Rights Act. There was mm-hmm. a lot of progress that happened. And then, as we saw last week, there's backlash again.
Right.
And there have been some people who have been discussing whether we are now entering a third Reconstruction.
Jeez.
And whether,
just sounds like a bunch of whiplash.
Yeah. mm-hmm. yeah. And so my perspective is that you know, this is definitely a time to mourn. It's a time to mourn what's lost, what should not have been lost. But it's like not a time for despair, and that there that we basically need to recognize that in the past, people didn't like just lay down their arms. There was more concerted effort in response that led to the needle still continuing to be moved forward. Mm-hmm. And so that's now our burden, our responsibility yeah. as we enter into this new era post-Voting Rights Act.
So I turn to my friend Stevie here for some positivity, right?
Okay.
I mean,
yeah.
So this landmark decision, we can see in the data, you know, just how many more Black politicians were elected in the years after the Voting Rights Act was signed right. into law, precisely. And how much voting rates increased.
Mm-hmm.
This decision, as the professor so eloquently laid out, I mean, this just feels like a turning point, right? So right. again, what is giving you hope right now? How do we keep up that fight you talked about earlier?
Well, we have to be strategic. We have to be politically strategic. I was talking to my fellow panelists in the waiting room about the reality of state legislatures across this country having trifecta leadership, cities across this country having Democratic leadership. The party that has routinely stated to be the party that is for the Voting Rights Act, protecting the Voting Rights Act, preserving the Voting Rights Act. And part of the reason that the Black vote is being diluted is because Black voters, more than any voter, vote for the Democratic Party 90% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a concerted effort to try to have a one-party control over Congress. I think this is a time for us to pivot to the local, make sure that we're taking care of our own house, make sure that we are taking the plank out of our own eye before we get so bogged down with trying to blow the speck out of the federal governments. There are things that we can do to assure that Black voter representation, Black leadership in our state legislature, Black leadership from Illinois and Congress is protected. And there are other ways to be leaders in this society
yeah.
outside of Congress. You know, the Civil Rights Act was not led by a bunch of congressmen or members of Congress. And so we can still do a lot. And we can still make noise, cause ruckus, and get in some good trouble and try to advance what we need to advance to protect our rights or advance our rights.
We'll have to leave it there. Stevie Vyas is executive director of Chicago Votes. Karen Freeman Wilson is president and CEO of Chicago Urban League and former mayor of Gary, Indiana. And Chika Okafor is assistant professor of law at Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. Thank you all so much.
Thank you
for having
great
us.
Great discussion. Let's turn now to the top Chicago area news stories of the day with WBEZ Morning Edition anchor Claire Lane and Chicago Sun-Times reporter Violet Miller. One of the biggest topics in the news and among friend groups is these insane gas prices lately, which just got even higher. So that is where we started. Claire painted a picture of what that looks like in the Chicago area. Here she is.
Will it ever end?
Yeah,
so
I don't know.
We should say that gas in some parts of the city has officially broken that $6 a Ooh. Gallon mark. Price comparison site Gas Buddy saying the average to your question across the city is $5.07. But in some neighborhoods, especially Northside neighborhoods, Bucktown, gas was $6.29 this morning. And that is for wow. a gallon of unleaded, just regular old gasoline.
Oh, goodness. And Violet, you've been doing lots of reporting on this. So tell me, you know, what is behind this spike?
Well, the war in Iran, you know, obviously the Strait of Hormuz has been a point of contention there. You know, anywhere between, I believe, 10 and 20% of the world's liquid natural gas flows through the strait. And so with that shut down, I mean, it's driving prices up. There's simply less supply while demand has stayed the same or increased. And so, you know, we're seeing that go up, and it's not going to come down anytime soon. Even if the war ended, you know, right now there's a process of demilitarizing the strait through mines and other things and also catching up to global demand. So prices are likely going to stay up for a while.
Goodness. Well, other things that we're seeing impacted here by these high diesel prices, Claire?
Certainly jet fuel. We'll be talking more about the closure of Spirit, I'm sure, on your show and throughout the day. But also agricultural strain. So farmers are facing some higher costs as well. They operate their tractors using fuel, machinery, also transporting a lot of their produce. So that's been disrupting the economy for farmers. Also, we know this. Anybody's been to a grocery store? I mean, all of our consumer goods here in the U.S. transported by diesel-powered trucks, trains, ships, right? We're all seeing more expensive groceries and various consumer products because of the hike. So it's, I mean, it's across the board.
Across the board. You touched on Spirit Airlines. I mean, big news over the weekend, right, Violet? Spirit Airlines shut down.
Bye-bye. Abruptly. Some of the memories I'm seeing posted on social media of people's various Spirit encounters have been quite memorable.
I mean, but the initial shock happened, of course, and people were left stranded, weren't they?
Yeah, there were actually competitor airlines that were offering vouchers to, you know, different like pilots and you know, crew members to get them home. But yeah, just, I mean, it's the second time they filed for bankruptcy in 2 years. They were expecting a federal bailout and they didn't get it. Mm-hmm. Again, these prices just put them under. And this is something we're hearing from a lot of airline companies right now is that the pressure is on as these, you know, prices continue to spike.
Yeah. Well, I think it's any company where the margin is that thin and you have a price increase of something this substantial. I mean, you're just unable to turn a profit.
That's what they're known for, right? They're this discount carrier. And so, of course, you know, this is what it leads to, abruptly ceasing operations and ending services to multiple destinations from our airports, O'Hare, for instance. And the bankruptcy struggles, the fuel costs, it just wasn't looking good. Wasn't looking good.
So long.
Yeah, so long, Spirit. Speaking of air travel, Claire, Chicago travelers, they may have few flight options overall from O'Hare.
Right. So United, as we know, the hub, one of their hubs is O'Hare, but they're cutting more than 100 daily flights from O'Hare this summer as all part of a federal mandate. This was in a letter to employees. The United-based airline didn't share exactly all of the flights that would be cut between May 14th and October 24th, but they did share that timeline. Fair to say, this is all in response to last month's request, Federal Aviation Administration demanding that airlines cut 12% of flights at O'Hare to maintain what they're saying is safety and to avoid potentially massive delays.
Yeah, all this talk of, you know, air travel, fuel costs. I think I just want to stay home. I think it's making me feel like I want to stay home. I mean, just you know, I, you know, get the middle grade of gas for my car and $6. I don't know how much longer I can sustain.
It's time for a bike, maybe.
It's time for that bike.
Lovely weather today. Try it out.
Yeah, it is time for that. Violet, I've been talking about getting this bike so much. Listen, In the Loop listeners, Reset listeners will have heard me say this. I'm going to hold myself accountable right now. I have not gotten that bike, but I'm going to do it.
I'd rather see you on rollerblades, Sasha.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm not a rollerblade gal.
Roller skates.
Roller skates, there maybe. Yeah, there we go. Violet, let's dig into some other news here. The U.S. Justice Department is investigating a whole bunch of Illinois school districts. What is going on?
Yeah, so Noble Charter among them, a CPS charter, but also, you know, a lot of suburban districts. The Department of Justice announced this investigation into whether these schools are teaching, quote, gender ideology, or whether they're accommodating trans students. But this is a sticky situation for the DOJ. It's been a losing battle. You know, Illinois state law says that schools have to do these things. Mm-hmm. And so IHSA, the High School Athletic Association, previously ruled that, you know, they were going to follow the Illinois Human Rights Act, and that's what the courts have held so far. So these investigations, it's really unclear what they are aiming to do. But, you know, obviously the threat of federal funding is something that the Trump administration has used to try and push school districts into, you know, kind of compliance.
Yeah, we're seeing a pattern here. I mean, Illinois U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, the Democrat, he's not happy about this. He's speaking out, isn't he, Claire?
Yeah, he called the investigation a, quote, sham. Mm-hmm. Durbin also just saying that if the Trump administration actually cared about supporting Illinois schools, that he would reverse the decision to dismantle the Department of Education and finally support some of our Head Start programs and stop attacking the Title I funding and the rights of LGBTQ plus students, as Violet is alluding to.
Right.
So we should say some of the investigated districts, Oaklawn, you mentioned Noble, and 17 schools in Chicago.
Wow, that's a lot. That's a lot. Now, Violet, anybody that's annoyed at the high cost of their gas bill, they might enjoy this next story. More than 1 million customers are going to be getting a bit of a refund. What's going on?
I don't want to get your hopes too high, but last week, Peoples Gas and North Shore Gas reached a $125 million settlement with Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul. The state had accused them of overcharging in certain ways to fund, quote, ineligible work. This was expired permits, among other things. They blamed the rising costs on their pipe replacement program, which is 5 years behind schedule and $1.3 billion over budget.
Mm-hmm.
So folks might be seeing those tax credits come in over the next 3 years. It'll be $50 this year and then $40 the next 2 years.
Oh, okay.
Eligible customers will have had to have been charged through these certain extra charges. So if you want to see all the specific ones, we got those in the story online at suntimes.com. But
I've
that's
got my magnifying glass out, ready to look for a refund.
You need to be.
I mean,
there's a lot of line items we're looking at as homeowners and taxpayers right now.
I'm pulling up that fine print, checking for those tax credits. All right, Claire, there's a strike at the zoo.
It's at Brookfield, so we should say, so not Lincoln Park. But yeah, more than 100 zoo employees walked off the job this morning.
What's going on?
They cannot reach a union contract agreement. They had a contract extension that they were running on. That expired on Friday. Members voted to strike. They're citing some unfair labor practices, also poor health care plans.
Poor health care plans. Interesting. We'll see how that turns out. Other stories that you're following?
Yeah, the Chicago Critics Film Festival is back. This year is kind of unique in that every film is a Chicago premiere. Music Box hosting the event, so 25 films are going to be shown at the Music Box through Thursday. It also includes a screening and a Q&A with Joe Swanberg. Mm. This is the new film, The Sun Never Sets. But Swanberg, Naperville Central, SIU Carbondale grad, has filmed many of his shows and movies here in Chicago, and he will be there for the Q&A on Thursday.
Nice.
So something to look forward to if you're a cinephile.
Yeah. Other stories that are on your radar, Violet?
Yeah, for sports folks, obviously it's been a big weekend for the Cubs and Sox, so they've been doing great. But more importantly to me personally, the first woman to pitch a Division I college game, Olivia Pichardo, retired a batter for the first time in D1 college history. So that was very exciting. Sealed the Brown University 16-4 win over Cornell. So the pressure might have been a little off.
Mm-hmm.
But hopefully we will see, you know, more from her. Obviously, Illinois is going to be seeing a lot more women's baseball with the WPBL down in Springfield this August. And then the Women's Baseball World Cup in Rockford at the end of July.
Nice. Yeah, you've been all over the sports beat lately.
I love it. It's a passion.
Yeah. That's Violet Miller of the Sun-Times and WBEZ's Claire Lane.
This episode of In the Loop was produced by me, Dan Tucker. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. If you like what you just heard, we hope you'll join us for more. We drop a new episode about Chicago news and culture every weekday afternoon, including our weekly news recap on Fridays and once a month, Ask the Mayor. Thanks for listening and have a great day.